How can anyone consider age to be a new problem? Obviously, there have always been the elderly and the aged in every society, and never in quite the numbers that there are in our society today. And never have the elderly been as vigorous, vital, full of capacity for as long as they are today. 1900, the estimated lifespan, the life expectancy of a newborn was only 47 years in the United States. A newborn male infant today has a life expectancy of something a little over 70 years, a newborn female child of over 77 and a half years. In 1900, those 65 and over, yes, unfortunately, that's the age limit that the sociologists use to define the elderly. Those 65 and over numbered 4% of the total population. Today, they number something over 12% of the population. Now, we have no way of knowing comparative figures from antiquity. But clearly, though the Bible tells us that the measure of life is 80 years, or perhaps by reason of strength, some 80 years, very few people in biblical times made it to that measure. Researchers estimate from their excavations and grave sites that the life expectancy in biblical times was something around 30, 31, 32 years. And they estimate that less than 1% of the population reached the age of 70 or more. Now, these factors have led many to speak of what they call the graying of America, by which they mean the increasing presence in our society of men and women who are elderly and aging and the aged, who have moved out of, for the most part, the world of regular employment. In 1900, 75% of the men in the United States who were 65 and over remained at their employment or were seeking employment. Today, the figure is about 20%. They estimate that in a decade, it will be only 10%. And so there has been a marked change in longevity, in the nature of the lives of the elderly. But the graying of America is not simply a fact due to the prolongation of life. It's also due to the loss of the desire of our children to have children, to the dropping of the birth rate. The prolongation of life is due to the miracles of modern medicine, to immunization and to antibiotics and all the rest. It's due to a more careful diet, it's due to more care for exercise. But the graying of America is to a larger degree due to the fact that the birth rate has dropped precipitously. You may have seen the figures that were released just a few days ago by the Census Department. In the last 15 years, the numbers who are of in our population who are 85 years of age and older has increased by over 19%, and the numbers of children 10 and under has decreased by about 4%. And since obviously the numbers of children are much greater in actual real figures than the numbers of those above 85 and over, that's a market swing which can be measured by this fact. In 1970, the median age of Americans was something on the order of 27 years. And today, it's something on the order of 32 years. And just as an aside, I should tell you that the median age in the Jewish community is not 27 years, and not 32 years, but 45 years. We are the oldest defined population within the American population. which says one thing clearly and loudly, and that is that our children, both men and women, are choosing professions over parenthood, and that the question of Jewish survival will really not be fought out on the grounds of assimilation, Jewish education, intermarriage, intramarriage, but will be fought out in terms of the birth rate. We are not statistically reproducing ourselves. Now, there are those who, having noted these figures, argue that in the post-industrial age, in societies like ours and those of Western Europe, the confrontation within the community will not be as it was in pre-industrial societies, a class struggle, but it will be an age struggle. It will be a struggle between the young and the elderly. They argue that for a whole variety of reasons, we have been able to close to a very large degree the have-have-not gap. And so we have been able to mitigate and minimize what the Marxists call the class struggle within our domestic economies. But the gap between the young and the aging is widening. And the burden that the aging are placing on the young is increasing. It's hard to remember how new the assumption is that the society as a whole has a responsibility for the health and the maintenance and the care of the aging. In most societies, up to very recently, an adult had to provide for his own old age, and the family was expected to provide the physical support for the aging, for their aging parents. And those who did not, who could not provide either the home or the financing, had to depend upon the erratic charity and tzedakah, on the almshouse that was set up in the community for worthy widows by some rich Mycenas. And if there was no almshouse, age and poverty were synonymous. But in recent years, the society has found the ways and the means to structure the support of the aged into the taxation system, the system of social welfare. But it's quite recent. It was in 1935, just 50 years ago, that President Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act. And that act represented a radical transformation of our conception of the responsibilities of the society vis-a-vis the aging. For the first time, the aged could look upon support from the community as a right due to them for their efforts up to that point in time. But what could not have been foreseen in 1935 was the burden that this Social Security system and the old age pensions that the government gives and Medicare and the like would place upon the young. Today, something on the order of 21% of all federal expenditures go to the support of the aged. It's a sum equal to 9% of the gross national product, and the sum is obviously rising. And there are estimates that by the year 2030, approximately 50 years from now, $1 in every $4 will be taken from every worker's paycheck in order to provide the necessary level of subsistence, of support, for the health provisioning of our elderly, of the 50 million elderly who will exist in the society at that point in time. And therefore, those who think about these things say that there will inevitably come a confrontation between the young lions and the gray panthers, between the young and the not so young. It'll come because the young will say, we have the larger financial burden. We have to provide for our children. We have to have money for a down payment on a mortgage in our house. We have to pay tuition for our children for college. And because the image of the elderly has changed. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, the image of the elderly was of destitution, the rapid diminution of power, and dependency. Today, second childhood is really another playtime. For many, once upon a time, you know, our children went north to camp in the summer. Now adult children go south to camp in the winter. And as the young look upon this growing body of able-bodied men and women, 65 and over, they ask themselves a very understandable question. Why should we be, in a sense, subsidizing people who are still able, competent to perform services in the society? And clearly the society is beginning to place more and more responsibility on each and every able-bodied worker to provide for their own old age. We've devised pension programs of various kinds and made them mandatory in most situations. The largest corporations in the United States, something on the order of 17% of the payroll is targeted for pension payments. We have set up programs which allow us to set aside monies which are not taxed at the present, to put them in a sense in enforced savings for the future. And more we are going to find ways of establishing means tests for those who are chronologically elderly, but really have no claim on the support of the society as a whole because they're well able to support themselves. And of course, the elderly will resist this change which is taking place, seems to be taking away something which they quickly became accustomed to. But in order for the society to provide some rough degree of equity, clearly some of these changes will have to take place. There is still a major problem of poverty associated with age, but it's not as universal as it once was. It's a matter of distribution. Actually, the percentage of the elderly who live with incomes less than the poverty level is less than the percentage of the population as a whole who are living below the poverty level. The figures are something on the order of 15.6% of those who are in the general population and 14.1% of the elderly population. And that number has dropped markedly. It was 30% of the elderly population who had less than a poverty level income just 15 years ago. And so the elderly are being seen as having, many of them, deep pockets, the capacity to provide for themselves. And clearly, if we're not to have an age war in our society, ways are going to have to be found to limit the claims of all aged, rather in order to be able to provide for those who really have need from the public coffers. There are new problems associated with age and aging in the United States. And many of these have to do with the purpose for which the aged turn to, and the society as a whole, turn to medical help and medical services, and the way these services are distributed. Many in the medical profession, because we are all caught up by our traditions, are still part and parcel of an old traditional attitude towards medicine that the purpose of medicine is to keep us alive as long as possible. And there's not a great deal of attention paid to what we mean by the operative term, alive. And so there has developed in our society what I sometimes call a Methuselah complex. Methuselah, you'll recall, is that legendary figure in the antediluvian era who was supposed to have lived for 969 years. According to Genesis, there were a series of great leaders who gave their names to the generations between Adam and Noah. And many of these people lived inordinately long times, according to the legend. Enoch lived for 800 years. Methuselah lived for 969 years. A man named Kenan is supposed to have lived for 910 years. None of that, of course, happened. These are simply the Bible's echo by a very common West Asian epic tradition about the longevity of the great heroes of deep antiquity. But nevertheless, there are those in the society at large who assume that the purpose of medicine, of medical research, is to keep us alive as long as possible. And then one of the things that medical research ought to be involved in is a breakthrough so that we could expand the limits of age. The Bible says, on the one hand, that the days of our years are 70 years and 10, perhaps 80 years. There's another tradition in the Bible, you know, bis 120 to be 120 as the measure of life. This comes from a chapter in Genesis, in which mythical chapter again, in which we're told that the sons of the gods and the daughters of men mated and they produced a new breed. And God is supposed to have said, man is not made to live forever. These people are of flesh. They will live no more than 120 years. Ad mea v'esrim. But whether it's 70 or 80 or 120, and there are something on the order of 20,000 centenarians in the United States today, there is clearly, and under present circumstances, a limit to life. It seems that there are built into most of our cells a time limit beyond which they will not reproduce, they will not regenerate and renew themselves. But there are those who are determined to eradicate death. And that would be a tragedy. We are meant to die. One of the commitments we make when we have children is to death, that we will make way for them, ultimately, to give them their chance, their space, their opportunity, that we won't so clog up the earth because of our own selfish desire to hang on to life, that there'll be no place for them and no opportunity for them to grow, to mature, to come to power, to organize the world as best they can. What the purpose of medicine ought to be is to keep us as young as we can, that we can be kept, as long as we can be kept within the limits of 120. And the emphasis here is on youth, and on vigor, and on capacity, on the ability of medicine to begin to conquer the degenerative processes, which now so quickly tend to sap the capacities and the dignities of those who move towards senescence and senility. We've already seen that because of diet and exercise and medicine, we've been able to transform the 60s and even the 70s into a period about which people assume vigor and vitality. But there's a limit. And geriatric medicine is just beginning to explore the ways in which the degenerative illnesses which afflict us can be retarded so that we will be kept as full of capacity as we can as long as our bodies hold out. And that, I think, is the legitimate role for medicine as it faces the new problem of age. But the problem is not that of medicine alone, because as medicine succeeds, and I'm convinced that it will, to a very large degree, the question is going to rest upon each of us. What are you doing? What are you going to do with this gift of years? Once upon a time, when a person reached 65 or 70, they were looked upon as elderly, and the respect which they gained had to be built into the society as a courtesy. It was no longer assumed that they were fully competent. You were to rise before the hoary head to show deference to the old. Why does the Bible insist on this? Because it knew that instinctively the aged were not respected. They were weaker. This was an authoritarian, patriarchal society. Once the young had displaced the old, they wanted them out of sight, out of mind. The old were often cantankerous and difficult and had to be assisted. And our society, at least, was determined to treat age with dignity by surrounding it formally with a number of courtesies. But in point of fact, there is now an age which is not age, an age which we are still fully competent, capable of making a contribution to our societies and to our families, to develop new talents. And the question is, what kind of use are we making of this opportunity? And I'm struck by one fact. Perhaps a fact which is as revealing of the preoccupations of our society as any other. And that is that an inordinate amount of effort is appropriately being applied to the financial preparation for age, for retirement. People save money, people have annuities, they see to it that their pensions begin to build up from the time they take their first job. They are careful to have some actuary work out the statistics to make sure that there'll be enough money set aside when they retire for their needs. We plan very carefully for the financial sides of age. We hardly plan for that dimension of age which deals with time, with use, with quality of life. I've seen person after person accept retirement without a thought of where the next step will take them. I'd like to erase the word retirement from our vocabulary. Retirement is a word which comes etymologically from a root which means to pull back from, to withdraw. And there are a lot of people who look upon retirement as a pulling away from life, a pulling away from responsibility. And most of us have known hard-working, capable, and competent men and women who worked until the moment of retirement. Let's say that they were in a profession, in a firm, in a partnership, which required retirement at a particular age. And suddenly, there they were, in that condominium which faces the sea in Florida, which they had enjoyed so much for 2 weeks every winter, looking out at that sea day after day after day, looking out at the green of the golf course morning after morning after morning, wondering each morning when they get up how to fill their hours, where they'll go for dinner, if there may not be a phone call from their children back north, only to break the monotony and the routine. And we see them a year later, 10 years older, bowed, their zest, their vigor drained, old before their years. The one thing we should have learned by now is that we can never allow ourselves to retire. We can never drop out. Last January, I was in London. And we went to see a retrospective of the work of Marc Chagall. Now, as you know, Chagall died 2 weeks ago. He can't paint any longer. He died at the age of 98. And there on the walls of the Royal Academy in London were several gigantic canvases which were painted when Chagall was 97 and 96 years of age. Chagall never retired. Neither did Picasso, neither did Pablo Casals. But you don't have to be a genius not to retire. All you have to do is to have some imagination and a will and be determined to stay with it, to be determined to be doing something. It doesn't matter what, as long as we conceive what we are doing to be valuable, to be using our talents, to involve us in our community, to involve us in life itself. So many people define the leisure years, the retirement years, as a child defines play. And then they play. And suddenly play becomes work. It ceases to be play. Because it has now a purpose, not simply a moment or two to back away from the pressures of life, but now it's all that there is to life. And so you have to make more of it than there's really there. We're meant to work. But work is not to be meant to be drudgery. We're meant to be active. We're meant to be part and parcel of a community. Some people plan for their latter years. They plan never to retire. Everyone should. But many times we have to, quote, retire. Then what? There are 1,000 ways in which we can be more active citizens. There are 1,000 ways in which we can start new undertakings, new businesses. We each of us have many talents which we have developed as avocations during our earlier years, which we can now develop more seriously. Each of us is a special blend of talent and of knowledge and of skill. It only takes a little bit of imagination and will to use it. But we can't use it if we retire. We withdraw when we pull back. I sometimes wish that we didn't define retirement in such a geographic sense. I don't know if the same applies in California or North Carolina and some calmer and warmer climates, but in Cleveland, people define retirement as moving away. Well and good, but when they move away, they almost always withdraw. And one of the ways not to withdraw is to continue to accept the challenges of a fully integrated community, a community with all kinds of ages and problems and responsibilities. When we continue to match our skills, our energies, our concerns against those who are younger than we. I am not sure that when sociologists come to write the histories, the sociologies, to evaluate these elderly retirement communities, they're going to end up by saying they were a valuable contribution to the well-being of the American people. Because what happens? Yes, there are activities, and they're scheduled at about the pace, a rather quiet, sedate pace of the elderly. But most of them are quite trivial. And very few of them involve real responsibility. Now here we have a bright, active, professional man, a lawyer, let's say, who's been part of the give and take of politics, of the judicial system, of the concerns of his community, all of his life. And he sees the brochure and the sun is shining, the golf course is green and the water is blue. And he's tired. Believe me, he's tired. And it sounds wonderful. So he goes. Now, he's not a man for macrame classes or finger painting. He's not a candidate for a dance class or aerobics. He's a candidate for a precinct chairman in Cleveland. He's a candidate for someone who will get active in a presidential campaign. He's a candidate for somebody who will lend his skills to those who need justice before the bar but can't pay full price for it. He needs to be involved, and he can't be involved in that way, in a world apart. We have to stay in our world. We have to be caught up in the community and in the family. And here's a real problem that we all face in a mobile and spread society. The family unit to begin with is small. Our children are scattered. As age comes, we are determined not to become a burden, God forbid. And so we withdraw. We pull away. But age is a time inevitably of loss, of widows, of widowers. When the friends of a lifetime begin to have their own scattering, some geographic, some because of mortality. And life can become a very lonely thing unless we remain open to friendship, unless we cultivate carefully and intelligently the ties of family. And many are loath to do that. Many are not trained in friendship. They've lived so busily, so actively that the business is, in a sense, the world in which they've lived, but now they no longer have the status and the power which goes with whatever office they held. They are no longer in that world. And so we need to cultivate new kinds of relationships. We need the skills which are the human skills. We can't retire. We can't expect our children always to come to us. We have to go to them. We have to open ourselves up to others. But many don't want to be bothered. It's not easy. They feel that they're more at ease with people who are like them, although every year there are less and less of those that they grew up with who are, quote, like them. And so aging is a lonely time because we weave a cocoon around ourselves, which becomes thicker and thicker, harder to break through. Age must be looked upon as an active time which requires imagination and will and energy. The more you do, the more you can do. The less you do, the less you will do. The more you sit on your hands and contemplate nothingness, empty your mind, the more your mind will rust. Rust long before it's time. I know a lot of people who are suffering what they believe to be Alzheimer's disease, who are suffering from nothing more than the television set. Instead of reading, they watch television. Instead of an interesting conversation, they watch television. Instead of thinking about the politics or reading the New York Times, they watch the soap operas. And then they wonder why they can't remember a name, or they can't remember what President Roosevelt did in 1936, or something that was once at their fingertips. Their minds have atrophied because they've let them atrophy. It's not Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is the most convenient excuse for loss of memory I know of. That isn't to say it doesn't exist, obviously. But it is to say that we are, many of us, as we approach age, lazy and unimaginative and unwilling to accept the challenge which age represents. For most of us, the worst of the financial fears once associated with age are behind us. There'll be enough. There'll be food on the table. There'll be a roof over our heads. We need less. But in one sense, we need more. We need more stimulation. We have to find ways to fulfill ourselves, responsibility. And nobody's going to come knocking on the door and say, here's your responsibility. Do it. Here it is. You got to seek it out. You got to find it for yourself. And it has to satisfy you. And this generation has no training in that kind of planning. We weren't trained to be parents, and now we're not being trained to be elderly. There are no models, really. The model that most of us have is of a parent who worked till they died. Of a mother or a grandmother who worked in the home, scrubbing and cleaning and cooking, till she went to Montefiore or to some other old folks. But now it's different. There are 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, more perhaps, when we're going to be condemned to leisure. And it's a penalty. Unless we know, we recognize this possibility. Unless we remain active, alert, involved, determined, committed, the kind of person that we are now. Amen.
Thank you.
May the time not be distant, O God, when the name shall be worshipped in all the earth, when unbelief shall disappear and error be no more. Fervently we pray the day may come when all men shall invoke thy name, when corruption and evil shall give way to purity and goodness, when superstition shall no longer enslave the mind, nor idolatry blind the eye.